A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Say Why to Drugs. Thanks to everyone who listened to and enjoyed the last episode with author Mike J about mescaline. I'm joined by another special guest for this one, Dr. Oliver Grundman from the University of Florida. Oliver is a clinical assistant professor and has expertise in medicinal chemistry and an interest in research into substance use. In this episode, he tells me all about kratom, a leaf that grows native in Southeast Asia and has mild stimulant effects in low doses and sedative effects at higher levels. It's been subject to media and governmental scrutiny in the USA recently, as a debate rages about whether to regulate it or research it. Without further ado, Oliver Grundman and I say why to kratom. So I guess the first thing is, can I just get you to introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, certainly. Thank you. So my name is Oliver Grundman. I got my bachelor's in pharmacy and my pharmacist degree from the University of Münster in Germany. And then fate kind of got me out to the U.S., to the University of Florida. And that's where I did my graduate studies in pharmaceutical sciences, primarily with an emphasis on the central nervous system activity of plant extracts. And that's what I graduated in, also primarily on a plant extract from Japan that actually exerted antidepressant and anxiolytic activity. And now I'm clinical associate professor at the University of Florida, director of the online programs in clinical toxicology and pharmaceutical chemistry. And my research focus is on central nervous system activity of natural products. Since 2015, I developed an interest in kratom, primarily because of the increased report of both toxicity as well as reports of beneficial effects, users reporting benefits of kratom.
Yeah, and so the reason that we first connected is because in my book that I'm writing at the moment, I wanted to write about kratom, but actually I didn't really know a great deal about it at all. And I came across a paper that you'd written and just kind of cold emailed you to ask sort of your advice. And you very kindly offered to read over the chapter. And so it seemed like a great opportunity to get your expertise about kratom. First off, could you just tell us a little bit about what kratom is?
I actually stumbled across kratom myself. It was a graduate student of mine that got me interested in it. Kratom itself is a plant or a tree that is native to Southeast Asia, so Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia. It is a tree that grows close to streams or to waterways. Both the tree itself, Mitragyna speciosa, as well as the leaf material that is harvested from it, is referred to as kratom. Sometimes natives also refer to it as ketom or biak-biak, depending on the region where you're in. The kratom is in the same family as coffee. So there is, when you look at the leaf, actually, it's kind of a waxy leaf, relatively sturdy. It's similar to the coffee plant leaf. So there is some similarity between the two.
But in terms of the psychoactive substance, it's not very similar to caffeine, that's right.
No, it is not. So in Mitragyna speciosa, in kratom, the current active ingredients that are really researched very heavily are mitragynin and 7-hydroxymitragynin, among others. And those look structurally much more complex than coffee, and caffeine and exert very different effects. Primarily, what is currently focused on is their activity on opioid receptors in a manner that is a little bit different from the activity that classical opioids like morphine or heroin would exert, but they definitely bind to opioid receptors.
And what's the appeal of kratom? Sort of who uses kratom and why do people use it?
In a traditional setting in Malaysia, in Thailand, or in Indonesia, the plant material has been used for centuries in two ways. So those who are laborers, day laborers, use the fresh leaves. They pick it off the tree, primarily aged leaves, so mature leaves, and chew on it briefly. And then they spit it out again. And then it has actually a stimulant effect that is somewhat similar to caffeine, to the effects of caffeine. And they do that throughout the day to basically maintain their stamina, because Thailand, Malaysia, these are all countries that are in subtropical areas where you have temperatures and high humidity. You have to be out and about for a long period of time during the day. But there's also a preparation where you have either fresh leaves or dried leaf material, and you prepare it as a decoction, as basically a tea preparation, and you cook it for a longer period of time, you steam it, and then in that form, you have more of an analgesic effect, a pain-relieving effect, and a sedating effect. So quite the opposite. So we don't necessarily know yet entirely how that works. Why we have this kind of opposite effects, brief exposure, chewing the leaves, you have a stimulant effect, longer exposure time in cooking or boiling the leaves, and you have a more sedative and pain relieving effect. But we know that these are the two main uses of the leaf material.
And that's how people often use the substance in places where the plant grows natively, so like Malaysia and places in Southeast Asia. But it's also being used quite widely, or certainly becoming more used, in the US as well, isn't it?
Yes. So we don't know exactly how far this dates back in terms of its usage in the US. The first reports, case reports that we have of toxicity, of adverse effects, and that is what we primarily have to rely on in the literature, date back to the early 2000s, but we don't know exactly how long it has been used prior to that by kratom users. We're uncertain about how far it dates back, but in the US, and that's where one of our studies was looking at, and some follow-up studies to that are being conducted based on a survey that we conducted in 2016, I think it was looking at about 8,000 current kratom users that were using kratom in various doses and also for what purposes. And we determined kind of four major purposes. One is purpose of using kratom to mitigate opioid or illicit drug withdrawal symptoms. So not necessarily only opioids, but also other illicit drugs that can be amphetamines, that can be benzodiazepines or other drugs to which somebody developed a substance use disorder. Then the second category was to mitigate withdrawal symptoms from a prescription drug. So that could be, in contrast to heroin, could be to a prescription drug such as an antidepressant, to which we know we can also develop a dependence, as well as to a prescription opioid. And then we had two other categories. One was to self-treat acute or chronic pain. And the last category was for self-treatment of an emotional or mental a disorder, no matter if it was diagnosed or not diagnosed. And a majority of folks in this survey were actually using it for the self-treatment of acute or chronic pain or for a mental or an emotional disorder, no matter if that was diagnosed or not diagnosed.
So what about sort of recreational use? Do people just use it for the intoxication effect?
There were people who were using it for that purpose. And that was not necessarily something that we looked at in our survey, but it was done in other surveys. And that is obviously something, if somebody wants to get high, so to say, on kratom, that is a possibility. One limiting factor with kratom is that it is a whole leaf, basically. It's just the dried leaf that is being crushed and powdered. So you cannot inject it. And hence, the only way to really use it is to ingest it, to either brew a tea out of it or dissolve the powder into a sludge and dissolve it into tea or make it with orange juice to avoid the bitter taste because it's not very tasty, and then ingest it. Getting high on it, there are definitely case reports that somebody was intoxicated with it, that they showed signs of intoxication, either of the stimulant kind or of the more sedative opioid-like kind. But you need to have significant amounts in your system. For a majority of people, it leads to vomiting, nausea, vomiting, or gastrointestinal symptoms before they reach that high, so to say. So it is not very common to reach that high of a concentration, blood concentration, of either mitragynine or 7-hydroxymitragynine.
Well, the next question I was going to ask you was about the intoxication effects, and I think we've already covered it a little bit. I'm right in thinking that intoxication onset occurs sort of 15 minutes to half an hour after a person's consumed it, can last for quite a while, sort of 4 to 6 hours potentially. And at small doses, we get this kind of caffeine-like stimulant effect, and at higher doses, we get something more akin to an opiate. Do we know much more about what intoxication on kratom is like?
From user reports, we know that the high that is achieved when somebody wants to get the same high that they expect to get from classical opioids like morphine or heroin, that kind of sedative, more relaxing, chilling high that one would expect to get from other opioids, they would prefer to rather stick to heroin or morphine than to switch to kratom. That has been shown by other researchers that have looked at that particular population of substance users who used kratom and also used heroin or morphine and compared the two. And it was definitely not preferred by those users. Instead, actually, they used it also as a mitigation strategy to reduce the heroin or substance use disorder consumption, basically. So it doesn't provide the same high. It does provide a somewhat relaxing, a low sedation level that one would expect to get from potentially a therapeutic or a high therapeutic end of an opioid. With the stimulant effect, initially in the literature, I think around the early 20th century, there were reports that it had a cocaine-like stimulant effect. Now, those have been kind of retracted and have been now more compared to a caffeine-like effect. If somebody were ingesting like 2 cups of coffee or something like that, it's not comparable to that of amphetamines or like. Darshan Singh has done some research in that regard and found that methamphetamine users, which is a large population, unfortunately, in Malaysia, are not likely to switch to kratom for their stimulant use from methamphetamine. So once again, it doesn't provide the same stimulant effects as you would get from methamphetamine, but rather a smoother or not as intoxicating level of stimulant effect. Now, that being said, we always have to consider the inter-individual variability in effects. There are people who are very sensitive to drugs versus others who are not as sensitive to drugs. And then we have enzyme expression level variability and all of these things. So there might be an individual who is very sensitive to these effects and others who are not as sensitive.
And I guess it's worth pointing out that people might be sensitive to some drugs but not others. So it's not necessarily you're sensitive to all drugs. It might be that some you are and some you're not.
Correct.
It was interesting what you were saying about it sort of being compared to cocaine, but then sort of thinking maybe it's more like caffeine. Perhaps it's sort of more similar to chewing a coca leaf than it is to snorting a line of cocaine.
Yes, I think that's a good comparison because the comparison was made at a time when snorting cocaine was obviously not really something that people did all that often. So maybe it was actually comparison to more of a coca leaf chewing, which is still traditionally done in Peru and other regions in South America.
If people take a very high dose of kratom, they can experience dizziness or nausea, can't they? Is that right?
Yes, that is definitely. And that was, in our survey, it was the most common adverse effects were nausea, vomiting, gastrointestinal, constipation, which is common with opioids, that were the most common adverse effects that people reported from it.
And in terms of then longer term effects, do we know much about those? So do we think kratom might be dependence forming, for example?
There are definitely reports in the literature that kratom can lead to tolerance and dependence. How this relates to the dose, we don't know yet. In doses that are usually recommended, 1 to 3 grams per dose, a majority of people that use kratom currently, in at least the surveys that were conducted to date and in the traditional setting in Malaysia, we know that most people use it, unless they chew it, if they use it more for the analgesic pain relieving effects, they use it in the range of 1 to 3 or 5 grams per dose. And that's when they usually stop. They don't go higher. And they use it between 2 to 4 times per day. That's usually how often it is being used. Above 5 grams per day, that's when you also see a rapid increase in adverse effects or higher risk of adverse effects, let's say that way. And you notice that there might be an increased risk for tolerance development and also the risk for dependence development. What has been seen, and Darshan Singh investigated that recently, is that the dependence that develops to kratom, and that has once again been shown, he conducted that study in Malaysia, and it was not as severe as for opioid use disorders. And therefore, patients that were misusing, abusing kratom or developed a dependence on kratom didn't perceive their dependence as severe. And usually within 3 to 7 days, the withdrawal symptoms would subside.
And what kind of symptoms might people experience in terms of withdrawal?
So what has been reported so far is agitation, gastrointestinal upset, sleep disturbances, general mood swings comparable to opioid withdrawal, but on a much milder level. So really the agitation is one of the primary things that somebody gets agitated, might be more aggressive or easily aggravated, and the gastrointestinal symptoms, diarrhea might be present, and then headaches are very common as well. Seizures have not been reported as far as I'm aware, although one should monitor depending on how high the dose was before. The seizure threshold may be lowered, so if somebody had any underlying conditions that might make them more prone to seizure disorders, then that should be monitored. There might be an increase in heart rate and blood pressure as well. So that should be monitored. And aside from that, nausea, vomiting as well can occur.
And in terms of any other long-term effects, do we know if people are putting themselves at risk by using kratom heavily over a long period of time?
So I think the one thing that needs to be pointed out, anybody who wants to use kratom, either for recreational uses or for self-treatment of any condition whatsoever, no matter if it's a diagnosed or non-diagnosed condition, should definitely be aware that it can cause drug interactions. We are not certain to what extent these drug interactions may contribute to potential fatalities, because there are case reports where kratom was reported in conjunction with the use of other drugs in fatalities. So that is something that people need to be aware of. And the best course of action in these situations is, especially if somebody takes already an opioid or any other drug that has CNS activity, including alcohol, it's important to consult with their healthcare providers in these situations before taking kratom. And especially if these kratom products are purchased over the internet, because some of these products may either be contaminated, adulterated, some of them do not contain adequate information on the label, And you might not even know what you're getting as a consumer, especially if we have something like something that is contaminated with fentanyl analogs or other opioids. That obviously puts the consumer at an imminent risk of overdoses, and that is a risk that they need to be acutely aware of.
For people who do use kratom over long periods of time, there have been some case reports of jaundice and psychosis, haven't there? Is that strong evidence that it might cause that, or is that quite weak?
So there have been instances and reports. So far, we only have case reports on that. So we can tell for certain if there are other underlying factors, if actually kratom was causative in that, or if the person already had an underlying disorder and it was a bystander effect that kratom contributed to it and wasn't actually the causative agent in it. We need more information to contribute to that at this point.
We've said this on the podcast many times before, that just because there's a lack of evidence doesn't mean it's not the case, but it just means that we can't tell either way at the moment. That there have been these case studies might indicate a higher risk, but we can't say for certain right now. So should we come on to some of the myths and misconceptions that exist around kratom? The first one that I've got is kratom is an opioid. And it wasn't me who came up with this myth. It was someone very high up in the US Food and Drug Administration, the commissioner, in fact, wasn't it?
Yes, the former commissioner, Dr. Gottlieb, who I regard as a very competent person, but on this one, he relied on data, the so-called FACE model, which is a computational model that was used, which basically is an in silico model, so a computer model, which you use. You have the opioid receptor modeled in the computer, and then you model the active pocket where the binding pocket where a molecule would bind to the receptor. And this is a great way to start your drug discovery pathway if you want to see how does your new drug actually interact with the target that you wanted to interact with. But it doesn't tell you much about what happens afterwards, because you cannot look at the complexity of the organism or even the cell. What does the cell do afterwards after the drug binds to that target, to that receptor, to the opioid receptor? So the first part of the statement that mitragynine, 7-hydroxymitragynine, and other alkaloids present in kratom bind to opioid receptors is true. I agree with that. Mm-hmm. And I think nobody actually wants to argue about that. But that they are just like opioids, that is, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many of my colleagues that I work with, is not correct, or needs to be refined, let's say it that way. Because what happens after mitragynine, 7-hydroxymitragynine, and other, at least mitragynine and 7-hydroxymitragynine, we know for sure, bind to it, is that there are two pathways that are activated in response to classical opioids, because the opioid receptor is what we call a G protein receptor. And I don't want to go too much into depth about that, but one pathway is the traditional one that everybody, kind of not everybody, but most of us who go to medical school or are healthcare professionals know about. It's like the secondary messenger pathway that leads to some kind of intracellular activity. But then there is a second pathway called the beta-arrestin 2 pathway that I actually never had heard of before I studied kratom. And this one is not activated by mitragynine and 7, or not recruited by mitragynine and 7-hydroxymitragynine. And it has been shown that that second pathway in particular seems to be associated with many of the adverse outcomes, respiratory depression, gastrointestinal side effects, and even dependence to some level. In addition to that, we also have to consider that mitragynine and 7-hydroxymitragynine are considered partial agonists, so they do not exert the same high activity as morphine or heroin are exerting at the opioid receptors.
I'm just going to try and see if I've understood that and explain it back to you. So what you're saying is, just because something acts on the opioid receptors, doesn't automatically make it an opioid. It's the effect that it has on the organism that's consumed it that defines whether it's an opioid or not.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so myth number two. The different coloured veins in the leaves of the kratom plant have different effects or come from different plants, or there's something special about the veins of the leaves being different colours.
We had a symposium in February of this year in Orlando at the University of Florida. We had quite a few folks from Malaysia at that symposium. And we were actually asking them, so what is it with the different veins? And they were asking us, what is it about the different veins? Because they don't distinguish between the vein color. They don't have green, white, or red veins, kratom. They don't have different trees with different vein colors. What they noticed is that during development, during maturation of the leaves, you might notice the vein color changing over time. So you might actually see white veins, green veins, red veins on the same tree. They don't distinguish between those. They just collect the leaves and that's it. So at this point, we do not know if there is actually any differentiation between those. What we do know is that there are no different species of kratom that would exert a different effect. And it has not been researched, to my knowledge, I couldn't find anything in the literature, that there are, based on the alkaloid content of mitragynine or 7-hydroxymitragynine, a distinction in the stimulant or opioid-like effects between red, white, or green-veined kratom.
Okay, so the last myth that I have, we've kind of already touched on this, but it's that kratom consumption can lead to death.
That's a tough one. Every death is a tragedy, obviously. And if kratom has been detected, I don't want to dismiss that kratom might not have played a role, potentially, in that death. The issue is that the way that we currently detect kratom primarily is through mitragynine alone. Mitragynine measured in the blood is kind of all over the place currently. So from the few medical examiner reports, the autopsy reports, the tox reports that we have, it's kind of all over the place, the blood concentrations. Sometimes we have lower blood concentrations than the one pharmacokinetic study in humans that we have. And then we have exceedingly high concentrations that would be very hard to achieve by just ingesting kratom as plant material, as a leaf material. What is missing is the causative link between kratom ingestion and the fatality. In addition, we have to recognize that in a vast majority of cases, I think except for one case so far, other substances were present in post-mortem in these fatalities. So either it was a benzodiazepine, it was alcohol, it was another opioid. Once again, linking kratom directly causatively to the death of the individual is not justified at this point. It might have been a contributing factor, but we have to realize that we have other substances on the market. If we look at loperamide, which is an opioid, which is used to treat diarrhea when we travel, for example, we have acetaminophen or paracetamol, as it's called elsewhere, which causes liver damage and death in thousands, if not tens of thousands of people a year, no matter if it's intentional or for children in many cases unintentional, because it's additive, it's a combination product in so many different preparations. I don't believe that, at this point at least, I don't see the evidence presented sufficiently that links the causation of a fatality to kratom exposure solely and as the causative agent.
And it's been, there was some deaths in Sweden that were linked to kratom, but that was a substance called krypton, I think is what it's known as, isn't it? Which is kratom mixed with a substance that's related to tramadol.
Correct.
Is that right?
The active metabolite of tramadol, or desmethyl tramadol, that was obviously intentional. It was not sold as Kratom even. It was already sold as a product that was sold really as a recreational product. And even the report itself, the publication itself, stated that O-desmethyl tramadol was found there and was likely the causative contributor to the deaths of these individuals.
Okay, so moving away from the myths now, does Kratom have any medical benefit?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The research that is currently being conducted, so actually the first time that Mitragynon was trying to be patented was back in the 1970s, and it never really went through. I don't know, because it was a natural product or there were other promising candidates. I don't know necessarily why that was the case. The patent was withdrawn. It is my belief that as a partial agonist that does not recruit beta-arrestin, it has promise as a new drug that targets opioid receptors in a manner that classical opioids currently do not. Does Kratom as a leaf extract have medical benefits? I believe so too. I don't think that necessarily all of the activity that is currently ascribed to it, all of the pharmacological benefits, all of the medical benefits that are derived from it, are solely based on the alkaloids. I think there is more to it, especially when we look at anxiety disorders, the antidepressant effects potentially. I believe there is more to the leaf extract than just the alkaloids. So I think it is worth exploring both the leaf extract as a whole, as well as potentially using mitragynon as a kind of scaffold, as a lead structure in the development of a new drug. The issue at the moment that we're facing is we have a relatively significant Kratom user population that is already using the leaf extract. If they're using it to mitigate or replace or self-treat their opioid use disorder, and we take Kratom away by placing it into Schedule 1 in the U.S. or into some restricted category in the U.K. or somewhere else, what is happening to those people who are successfully treating their opioid use disorder? I understand that there should be a medical provider involved in helping those people treat their substance use disorder. I agree that that should be done under medical supervision, and I encourage everybody who is currently using Kratom for mitigation of a substance use disorder to consult with their medical provider, because that is the best way forward. Usually only using Kratom or any other medication by itself is not the best treatment approach, especially if you do it by yourself. The therapy in combination with a drug is the best way to really solve the problem and get away from it long term. I think that Kratom has a use if it is used responsibly. That is my opinion.
Okay, I mean, that kind of brings me on to the last question that I have, which is, what don't we know about Kratom? Sort of, what kind of research is ongoing? What are the questions that people are interested in relation to Kratom?
Well, we actually know quite few things about Kratom. So in regards to its dependence and abuse liability, we know very little about it. We know that there is a dependence potential for it, but we don't know exactly if it is mitragynon which is responsible for it, or if it's 7-hydroxymitragynon. I hinted earlier at this when I said that we don't actually know if 7-hydroxymitragynon is present in the native extract, in the native leaf material, or if it is a product that is generated during the drying process or something along those lines. So that is still something that we are after. We don't know much about the other alkaloids that are present in the leaf extract and in the leaf material. And that is something that might help us to figure out, is mitragynon actually the best lead structure for a new drug to be developed? Or is the overall effects of Kratom really an interplay of all of these different alkaloids and potentially other compounds that are present in the leaf extract? a lot of questions remain unanswered at this point that we still can look into and that still need to be explored, all under the assumption that Kratom and Mitragynine and 7-hydroxymitragynine are not being scheduled at this point.
Well, it sounds like it's quite an exciting field to be working in anyway.
Kratom is definitely exciting to conduct research, and the many people that I have been working with has been really a pleasure and blessing, and also the email exchange that I get and the emails that I receive from regular folks, so to say, that describe their experiences with Kratom has really humbled me and taught me that there is so much more that we can learn about Kratom.
Well, that seems like a great place to end it. So, Dr. Oliver Grundmann, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And there we go. Research into Kratom is ongoing, as Oliver said, so watch this space. Say Why to Drugs will be back in 2 weeks' time. In the next episode, I'll be joined by Dr. Amir England to talk about cannabidiol, one of the components that makes up cannabis, and one that has been appearing on our high streets in recent months. Thanks as always to Adam Richardson for the artwork, to Jim Murray for the music, and to the Distraction Pieces Network for generally being lovely boys. See you all in a couple of weeks. Bye!
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.